You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me.
David Heydu returns to the show this week. He's the author of many fine books, including the great biography, Positively Fourth Street, The Lives and Times of Joan Baez, Bob Dylan, Mimi Baez, Farinha, and Richard Farinha, and The Essential History of Popular Music, Love for Sale, Pop Music in America, and the brilliant book, The 10-Cent Plague, The Great Comic Book Scare and How It Changed America. He has two recent publications, a graphic novel that tells the story of vaudeville through the lives of three performers, A Revolution in Three Acts, and David Heydu's first novel, Adrian Geffel, A Fiction. David Heydu is also a professor at Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism, and a journalist and a songwriter. David Heydu, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
I'm very happy to be back with you, Gary. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, now that I've read all of your credits, we're out of time, but thanks so much for coming.
It makes me say, I guess I sound a little bit like a dilettante when you hear, oh, and he wrote the novel and the songwriter, but I'm getting old. So there's been a lot of time to do a lot of things. And I waited a long time to try to do certain things till I felt like I was ready. So not quite as much of a dilettante as it probably looks.
Well, you're much older than me because you were born in March of 1955 and I wasn't born until June.
That's right. So I want your respect.
let's start by talking about this novel, Adrian Geffel. It's your first novel. It's very funny. I laughed a lot.
I'm glad.
What inspired it?
Well, it's a novel of ideas. I mean, it takes place in a landscape. It evokes a time and place, and it's all about a set of characters, and there's a love story and it's all that. But it's also an inquiry into a handful of ideas, particularly one big idea in particular. And it started from that. It started with me, actually it started from a class I taught at Columbia, where one year I brought my students to see a musician I admire a lot, I've written a lot about, I'm not going to name the person, but writes gorgeous, rich, Aaron Copland kind of like harmonically dense orchestral jazz. The same year, I brought the same class to see an avant-garde composer who writes very difficult, challenging work that's hard on the ears. My students walked out of the first performance and came into class, the next class, and said, well, what's good about that? And then when they saw the other performance, they just assumed that it was great because they didn't understand it and didn't like it. And that got me thinking, well, you know, there's reasons for this and I'm not going to blame them, but you know, but what are those reasons and what happens and what leads us to assume work that not only challenges us, but this upsets us or distresses us. Why do we equate that with quality and seriousness and intellectualism? And why are we so suspicious of beauty and pleasure? And so it came, the book grew from that set of questions. And I thought, well, how can I give form to that? And I had taken those things up here and there in some essays I've written over the years. But I thought, well, what if there were a musician who made music everybody hated? And my mind just started spinning like that. And I thought, well, what if then that person became a big star? Right? Because nobody liked it. So it was just, then that situation took off. And it took off. And the characters became very real to me. And the whole thing became very real in the way that, you know, other people have written fiction talk about, you know, after a while, the book kind of wrote itself and the characters told me what they were going to do. And that has sort of happened with me. So that's how it started, it with this idea of a woman who turned out to be a woman who was afflicted with a rare neurological disorder that I made up. But that's how it started.
Right. She hears music in her head. So therefore, whenever she actually hears music, it makes her miserable.
Right. It's called psychosynesthesia. And there's a couple pages of technical language about explaining it, which is all fabricated. she makes music that is an expression of her emotional state at any moment. Like however she's feeling comes out in her music. So it's pure unmediated emotional expression, kind of pure emotion given form in music. And because she's kind of troubled, the music is troubled. And that, you know, upsets some people, except critics who love it. So it's a kind of a satire of my own tribe. You know, it's a satire of the world I live in as a critic and my own tribe as a scholar and as an academic. There are a couple, you know, there's an unbearable academic in there and a critic kind of full of himself. It's only partly me. It's a parody. It's a satire. It's a lot of laughs. I think.
I find it very funny.
That's good. But then in the end, ultimately, when I think about it, it's kind of sweet love story about these two girls who fall in love. So that happens in the end to be my favorite thing about it.
Well, the real life singer-songwriter who I love, and I know you love, Jill Sobule, makes a cameo appearance in the book, obviously.
In the book, well, there's a couple of real people. And Philip Glass is in the book.
That's right.
As a plumber. Because he was a plumber in this time period. He really did. And in his memoir, he devotes, even if you didn't read it, he still did this. He devotes devotes a few pages to the proper way to replace a toilet. So in the book, Adrie's girlfriend is a contractor and she needs to do some work. So, you know, Philip Glass replaces their toilet and it's utterly plausible. He took great pride in his ability to replace a toilet properly. And, you know, and somebody in the book says, well, I don't want to disparage Philip Glass. He's a, you know, he's a nice guy and a great plumber. And Jill, so in the George Saunders makes an appearance, the fiction writer, and Jill, in the book, she wrote a song about Adrie. There's a long set, not long, but there's a section in Adrie goes missing, and the book is an inquiry into whatever happened to this woman who disappeared mysteriously one day. So that's the premise. She disappeared mysteriously. So the author, who's a version of me, is interviewing various people to put together the story of Adrie's life. And in the end, there's a section of, gee, what really happened to Adrie? And there's a reference to Jill Sobule writing a song about her. And then Jill's a friend and we've written a bunch of songs together. So Jill read the book and she said, hey, I should write that song. So she did.
I think I met Adrie once in a dream. I asked her to sing with me. She said, oh, no, no. Oh, no, no. In my part of heaven, we don't sing. We scream. We scream.
Oh, you know, I think there's some obvious ties between Adrian Gefil and your pop music history, Love for Sale, which is such a great, wonderful.
Oh, thank you.
That I love.
Thank you.
But now that you're mentioning the idea that your students assumed that things that were complicated were good and things that were not so complicated, what's good about that, makes me think of the 10-cent plague and the whole idea that a comic book can't be good because it's easy to read or because it's
right. It's for fun. It's for kids or it's for kids. Yeah. You know, adults who can control the culture for so long. And I think that things are shifting a bit now at our moment. When adults control the conversation, the cultural conversation and set the rules, work that was for kids, for young readers, young listeners, young viewers, was held in suspicion. And even more so if it was made for kids and by kids, the way that comic books were, particularly in the beginning. Very young people made comics. And that's also true of popular music. It was true in the early days of jazz. People don't remember Ella Fitzgerald was 15, 16 when she made her first record. Doris Day was 16 when she made her first records. So, you know, music that's made by and all art, popular art that's made by and for young people is held in suspicion. I don't know where we could go with that. But
yeah, no, it's interesting. I mean, I remember when I was a kid that I didn't take the Jackson 5 seriously because they were kids. Just, in fact, one of them was in my gym squad in my junior high school. And so I didn't take their music seriously until later when I realized, oh, this music is incredibly great. I associated it with, you know, the Osmond brothers or something. Right. Music I didn't think was particularly good. And that was because I think, like you talk about in Love for Sale, we're programmed to like things that are hip, and we're afraid to like things. We're afraid to like things that are not hip, even though we like
them. Right. Taste that we can wear, you know, to achieve some kind of status or standing within our social group or in the social group that we want to be a part of. And sometimes we, you know, we hold back our real tastes. And, you know, I was, we're almost the same age, although I am older. Young.
I'm
older. No, I am older. Yeah. The punk era, you know, I liked punk. I got it. And I was in New York at the time, and I went to CBGB's and I went to Max's Kansas City. And I saw Talking Heads as a trio and I liked it. But I really also liked disco, you know, but like you couldn't admit it. You couldn't talk about it because then I wouldn't quite be accepted in that group. And one thing I teach a seminar in criticism at culture at Columbia, cultural criticism at Columbia. And I ask the students what their favorite movies are, what their favorite books are. And I often hear things like, well, I like that a lot. I know it's not really good, but I like it. And I said, well, stop right there. Because if you like it, there's something good about it. You know, I like Cardi B. I liked Call Me Maybe.
Yeah. It's a great song.
It's a great song, right? It's a great song. But, you know, fortunately, the culture catches up to popular culture. And, you know, what's the work that's disreputable, looked down upon, like, you know, the blues is all, it's salacious, it's crude. The jazz is all just a beat, you know, it's animalistic. The culture kind of hip hop is, there's no melody, there's not, no music. The culture catches up eventually.
Oh, right. Yoko Ono used to seem like such a far out crazy musician. Yeah. And now her music just seems very tame and lovely.
Yeah, I feel that way about The Clash.
Yeah. Really, I mean, they were so loud and crazy, and now you think, oh, that's good. It's kind of like the Dave Clark Five.
It's so catchy. It's like, it's like catchy pop tunes.
I think Lost in a Supermarket could have been on a Dave Clark Five record.
Yeah, and now I can't remember why I heard it as so accostive and abrasive and difficult anymore. Like, I can't go back and recreate that feeling. Do you feel that way?
Yeah, your ears are just, it's not new anymore. And now it's just, I mean, even, you know, like when Elvis Costello first came out and his stuff was supposed to be this angry thing. And you know, he's been around for so long and he's a pop singer and it's all part of the pop music thing.
Right.
Yeah.
But, you know, but together. Time and some perspective does help. And sometimes cultural institutions that reward artists are behind the culture itself and are kind of late to give artists their credit. I served on the Pulitzer Prize for Music a few years ago, and we met. It was a great committee. We listened to over 120 pieces of music over 3 days, and It was a very rich experience. And at one point we were deliberating over an oratorio that had incorporated some strains of hip hop in it. And we're talking about, well, much to the composer's credit, that the composer drew from this vernacular form from hip hop and to make this oratorio. I started scratching my head and thinking, well, if that vernacular form is what gives this its power, why aren't we considering work done in that form and only recognizing it as a resource for the white elite music, you know, high tone music? Isn't that a problem? Like, why aren't we considering hip hop? Like, there was no 120 pieces of music, no hip hop. And at that point, no popular music had ever not been considered for ever won or been a finalist for a Pulitzer. I mean, not Pet Sounds, not Exile on Main Street, not Hejira, Hissing of Summer Lawns, not any of the great works that we know. So we deliberated and said, well, why don't we consider Damn by Kendrick Lamar? And one of the jurors said, who's that?
Right, because he wasn't 13.
And we listened to it, and everybody said, well, this is really great. And he got the Pulitzer Prize that year. Kendrick Lamar got a Pulitzer Prize for music.
Wow.
It was very gratifying to all of us. You know, we're all in that together. It was a mutual decision. It was great. But looking back on it, it's striking. And the way I felt at the time was, it's striking that this powerful institution is just so late to recognize what's interesting that's going on in the culture because it's popular, or in this case, because it's black.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. We're talking this week with cultural historian David Haydu. He's the author of several books, including The 10-Cent Plague and Positively Fourth Street. His new book is called A Revolution in Three Acts, The Radical Vaudeville of Bert Williams, Eva Tangue, and Julian Enting, and a new novel, Adrian Geffel, A Fiction.
In your graphic novel, A Revolution in Three Acts, one of the people that you talk about is Eva Tangue, the I Don't Care girl. And one of the things that happens to her in real life and in your story is that because she's not new anymore, because history catches up with her, mm-hmm. It basically ended her career.
Yeah, right. That's right. Something very similar happened to Julian Elting, who's one of the second of the three characters. But she was, you know, radically innovative. And for a time, there's no one like her at the time. She challenged all the values of Victorian proprietary, every concept of what womanhood represented and what was proper. And for a woman coming out of the Victorian era, this is in the turn of the 20th century, a period when the world was just coming out of Victoriana. And she was a challenge to all that. Sexually dynamic and assertive. She had a dynamic physical presence, kind of this wild, unkempt, loose, unpredictable, you know, presence. And she would prance wildly around the stage, like, you know, she was often called like a mad woman or wild. Often associated with kind of with madness or craziness, was that which she enabled as a way to give her kind of license to be provocative, and was the doing this, challenging everything the world thought was acceptable and proper and right for a woman. She became the number one draw in vaudeville, which was the most popular form of entertainment at the time, and the highest paid woman in America. So doing everything that the world said was wrong, she was enormously popular. But what happened was she never really changed her act. And she was an enormous influence. A generation of performers came up then emulating Eva Tangue. She changed performance and changed the world. Really, she changed the way that people thought about womanhood, thought about propriety, She thought about the rules regulating engagement between the genders and all blah, 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 all sorts of stuff. And then Mae West comes out in her wake. Sophie Tucker comes out in her wake. Other whole wave of women are influenced by her, you know, Black and White, and some man. He changed the world. The world changed, but she didn't change. And after 10, 15 years doing the same thing, she just seemed passe. And the same thing happened, like, continuing to express.
Yeah.
Same thing happened with Julian Elting. He was a female impersonator, but not a female impersonator in the way that we think. He didn't do a drag act. It was grounded in parody and kitsch and camp. It wasn't like an over-the-top take on being a woman. It was what he presented as a precise replica of a woman. Like and the Victorian ideal of a woman. It was a very strange act. He didn't sing, he didn't dance. He just came out and passed himself off as a very proper, you know, beautifully attired, elegant woman of the 19th century, essentially. Strange, and also very successful, and kind of turned everybody upside down and inside out, because, you know, men found themselves attracted to this figure on stage, and by the end of the act they learned it was a man, and like, and then what, you know, what did I just go through? And then women emulated her. Julian Elting published a magazine called Julian Elting Magazine that provided beauty tips for women, and he sold products. So what he represented in elementally was an argument that the gender is fluid, you know, and anybody could be a woman. What being a woman boiled down to was, you know, knowing the rules and following them and doing this prescribed set of things. Do these things and anybody could be a woman. Very 21st century idea. He was very much a figure of the 21st century 100 years earlier. But he got outdated too, because within 5 years, a whole wave of female impersonators came up under his wing, but doing a crazier, wilder, freer, more adventurous kind of female impersonation. It was called the pansy craze. Seriously, Google, there was a craze for drag acts in the early 20th century. And he started to look very outdated. And the same thing happened to both of them. They were undone by their influence. Their influence was so great that it made them outdated.
I always find it interesting that there's a certain aspect of sexuality that for some reason is acceptable in certain circumstances, where it's completely unacceptable in other circumstances. Like when I was a kid, Joey Heatherton was on TV all the time. And I thought, well, how come why is it okay for Joey Heatherton to do what she's doing, but if you're caught looking at Playboy, you're going to get in trouble? Or how come ballerinas can dance around with their bodies, but if it's if it's Gypsy Rose Lee, that's bad, you know?
Yeah. Oh no, that's a big question, and I wondered about Joey Heatherton myself, and made a study of her when I was made a point to watch her as often as possible to try to unravel this intellectual question of yours. Jill, we mentioned Jill Sylvia, wrote a song about her called Joey. It's just really great. Maybe if you have it there, it's called Joey. And it's, Jill has a knack for telling a story in a song and evoking a character, and for entwining fun and tragedy, you know, and the dark and light together. And she does that with this, because, you know, Joey Heatherton took a strange turn, or that's a good question. You know, I've always thought that it's a good question.
Well, you know, since we spoke last, which was in 2016, you know, everything has happened. It's almost like a whole nother world than it was in 2016. And I was even thinking about how the 10 Cent Plague, your book about the comic book scandal of the 1940s and 50s, and in the subtitle of your book, you say how it changed America, but it really, how it changed America became evident in the last few years. I mean, it's kind of a blueprint for how the right can use a lie to create a movement, because there wasn't any connection between comic books and juvenile delinquency or anything like that. And yet they basically destroyed an industry.
Right. It's a testament to the power of a great story or a drama or a magnetic personality, you know, because these kinds of arguments don't have the power they do because they're arguments. You know, it's the power grows from who makes them, how they're made, and the narrative form that they take. So we have, you know, McCarthy and the right wingers arguing, and Frederick Wortham. We have the charismatic people who are very persuasive, you know, and convey credibility and conviction, telling us a story about kids, good kids, read comics, warps their mind, makes them perverts and killers. Like, you know, but there's Frederick Wortham in his white lab coat, you know, or there's a person in the White House, you know, right?
Right.
Who's the president, but speaking with, I don't really want to get, you know, Trump represents someone who is so comfortable lying. You know, it's like he lives in the myth, so myth that the myth is utterly believable, and to, you know, if you're susceptible, you know, actually, you have to fight him to actually find the truth, because it's, you know, he says, I don't want to devote too much time to Trump. I've had such a nice day. But so what I'm getting at here is, you have a charismatic figure, you have a star. He always said, and Trump used to say, when you're a star, you can do anything. And he used that as an example of what he could do, you know, the sexual abuse that he was trying to. When you're a star, you're a star and you're a celebrity, you're an object of idolatry, and you have a good story, and you can perform it well. All those things come together, and they're incredibly powerful. And that's what made so many demagogues so dangerous. And maybe I've been teaching too long, but I can't help but connect that to Plato and the Republic, you know, because he knew this in the classical era, that he was very suspicious of. He thought the drama was dangerous and art was dangerous, because he knew the power that it had, you know. And so in a way, if I could build one more point off of that, it's a powerful argument against the argument that, oh, come on, let us make these comics. It doesn't matter. They're only comics. Oh, come on. They're only stories. They're only drawings. It's only comics. It's only art. No. The truth is, because it's art, it has a power that's you really need to recognize. It's a force. You know, the idea that's only a drawing or only art is really problematic. That because it's art, it has a really powerful force. And I think that explains Wortham. You know, he was an artist as a performer, and Trump. And they're very dangerous.
Well, and that brings me back to your history of popular music, the Love for Sale. So, that is everything that people who feared Elvis Presley, the thing that people feared most about rock and roll, all the things that they feared, every single one of those things happened.
I mean, that's right.
Their fears were justified. Yeah. They didn't want them to happen, but they happened.
Right. They're and the same thing about comics. I mean, I think that's what was great about comics, and that's what was great about rock and roll, that it did have the power to change the way that you thought and change the way that you feel and change the way that you act, because it wasn't just music. It's only rock and roll. No, only rock and roll. No, that's a construction I don't buy. No, rock and roll really changed the way it made people in many superficial ways. Yes. But it also, in deeper ways. And this is one of the great things I think about popular art, that it has the power to kind of lead the culture and shift the culture and change the culture. Rock and roll was integrated before the schools, you know, and before that, swing music, which was originally a black music that became a multi music made by, you know, a variety of races, but was elementally black. Music was integrated before the schools.
Weren't you saying, I mean, I think it was your father that you said was sure that Benny Goodman must have had black blood in him, or Elvis Presley had to.
Yeah, a little woodshed in his blood. Yeah, my father. Yeah, a little woodshed. It's true. My father, my father was a mill worker, but smart. And he's picking up, there's a strain of African American identity in that school of work. That's what he's saying.
You're listening to From the Bookshelf on KSCO. I'm Gary Shapiro. We continue now with our conversation with David Haydu. He is an author and a cultural historian. His new book is called Adrian Geffel, A Fiction, and he has a new graphic novel called A Revolution in Three Acts.
I talked about disco a few minutes ago.
Yeah.
Popular music and disco shifted, and glam rock shifted attitude toward sexual roles, before the enlightenment and the rise of gay consciousness. It was it was a piece of it, but a part that that led a larger culture and a broader culture in a very strong way. So, I think popular music was there first. I talked to Leslie Gore about You Don't Own Me. You Don't Own Me came out 62 or 63. I can't remember, actually. Anybody listening, you can Google it and you'll know before the end of this sentence. But it was the same year as Jack Jones' Wives and Lovers. So, right? So the same year when, like, the parents upstairs in the living room are swinging to Wives and Lovers, this demeaning sexist song. The kids down in the rec room are listening to You Don't Own Me, and it's really leading them into another time and another way of thought.
I think the Beatles too had a lot to do with gender fluidity, and that they were the first. People don't remember that now because their hair is the same length as Ted Koppel's, but when their hair arrived, people thought, oh my God, are they boys or girls? Right. And it's so shocking.
There's no question about that. It's an aspect of the Beatles that's not often enough discussed, I think. And with the high falsetto that they sang in, the tight harmonies, the fact that Paul and George use one mic,
when they lean
so
in.
Close. So, the lips were almost touching, singing in one mic. It was their act was very, very sexually transgressive. Not to mention the fact that Americans are ignorant of this weird attitude toward the British, and kind of conflate the British with homosexuality in a really ridiculous, stupid way. Elvis, do you remember when Elvis met the Beatles? Remember what he said?
No, what did he say?
They seem like a bunch of fairies.
That's funny. Well, there's a scene in A Revolution in Three Acts, your graphic novel about vaudeville, in which Eva Tengray is about to be arrested for indecency or something. Yeah. And I was thinking, okay, and the reason that they were so upset about her and why they wanted to arrest her is because they could see into the future and they could see Megan Thee Stallion.
It's
everything,
funny.
Yeah, everything they're afraid of happens.
Well, She was arrested in a couple of cases, but that in particular story, which I should mention, was drawn by the magnificent artist John Carey, who was my collaborator on the book. He drew the final drawings for the book, and he's brilliant. Shows her escaping, wrapping a coat over her nude body. You know, they're out to arrest her because she's defying the law, because the law has been made to protect the public good by some set of rules, you know, and it takes a lot for us to understand that the flaws in those rules and the flaws in laws and the change but people like Tang, I say people like Tang Wei. There was nobody like Tang Wei at the time, but rare figures such as Ava Tang Wei, you know, really can change the world. I was thinking, if she existed today, you know, she'd make Cardi B, she'd do something that was so out there, like Cardi B would sound like the singing nun. You know, she'd probably have sex on I mean, she wouldn't be singing about sex or something, she'd already be doing it, or else I don't know. And she'd be like, maybe she'd be a performance artist and cutting herself up on, who knows, she'd be, you know, it would be out there. It'd be something we'd really have trouble, really have trouble coming to terms with. We'd struggle to come to terms with, because it would seem so wrong. And that's what would be so great about it.
I'm also interested in one of the things that runs through all of your books, I think. And I don't know if it's something you're consciously aware of talking about, but all of the things, all of the media of entertainment that we love, whether it's vaudeville or Walkmen or iPods, they all go away eventually. You were talking about how, I think you said that if you sold 1 million copies of a record, you could make $40,000. And if you have 1 million downloads, you could buy a pizza.
Buy a pizza. Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah,
like the right. Rapidly changing. And it, I mean, just in our lifetimes, it's changed so radically and so quickly. Yeah.
Well, I am fascinated by the relationship between technology and art, particularly popular art, and how shifts in technology trigger shifts, sometimes radical shifts in the way that art is made and the way that it's received and the impact that it has. It's obvious in the case of records and recording. You know, we could go on for 3 hours, like what was the impact of recordings or radio? Well, radio democratized art. It brought it into every home. It was intimate. People, singers could sing at their conversational volume. People listened to sound like somebody's in the room with them. That changed the way that people wrote songs. So they now wrote songs that were different. They were much more intimate. And singers such as Bing Crosby and Frank Sinatra came up, who sang in this murmuring Billie Holiday in a conversational way that would have made no sense. So they would have been completely wrong 10 years earlier, you know, but now they're right because of the technology. I'm fascinated by that. I like to write about that and I like to write about it. The other thing that the books all have in common, which I did not realize until I finished The Revolution in Three Acts, which is actually my seventh book. So all these years, I wrote all these books, you know, there's a jazz book, there's a book about four characters in the folk music scene, there's a book about comics in the post-war years, there's a collection of essays, there's a novel about the avant-garde of the 80s, there's a book about vaudeville, the turn of the 20th century. They all seem unrelated, you know, they seem like, and I did each one at the time because I was looking for a new challenge and a new subject area, a new set of challenges that would push me. But I look back on them now, Gary, and I say, well, every single one is about young people coming to New York to find themselves through art. And in the course of that, changing the world. It's like,
yeah, yeah.
every single one. I thought, well, I need to get a new shtick, you know?
Well, New York is the place for that, isn't it?
But then I told this to my wife. I said, honey, I didn't realize. Oh, she said, oh, you know what that means? That means they're all about you. Oh, well, I guess so, maybe, I guess, you know.
Well, did you come to New York or were you born in New York?
Yeah, I came from New Jersey.
Oh, so it's not that big a journey.
Well, that's what you think. But but if you lived in New Jersey, New York's another world, you know. And the people in New York think of New Jersey as another world. So, you know, Bruce Springsteen has the first 10 years of his music were all about crossing the river, you know.
That's right. Yeah. You know,
I'm not going to do my Bruce impression. the move from New Jersey to the move to New York, growing up and danger, sophisticated danger, blah, 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 blah.
I saw Sinatra in concert many times. One time, this guy next to me stood up and yelled, Hoboken! He just couldn't contain himself.
I saw him, only, I think we've, six or seven times. I consider myself so lucky. What was your favorite? Did you have a favorite moment or was that it?
Yeah, no. In 1981, I saw him at Harris in Tahoe. It was on Valentine's Day. And he did a special show that was no strings, all brass.
Oh, wow.
Orchestra.
That's unusual.
And he was singing really well. And, you know, I thought he was old, but he wasn't that old then.
He sounded great to the end.
Yeah,
he was very, very different. He learned how to use all the what we would think of as the flaws in his voice. You know,
yeah.
He used it all for expressive purposes. The cracks, the grouch, the croaks, the crones, the shortness of breath. You know, all those things that, would in another person's hands would be liabilities or limitations. He turned them all into strengths. He's an amazing artist.
I think almost every time that I saw him, he made some song decisions that I didn't like, because I never want to hear, I don't really want to hear Bob Dylan singing Frank Sinatra, and I don't want to hear Frank Sinatra singing the Beatles or anything like that. I really can't stand it when I hear Ella Fitzgerald singing, Feeling Groovy or something like that.
Okay. this is a radio show. I agree with you. I mean, especially when he does soft rock, he does If by Bread.
Yeah.
And there are Bad, Bad Levi Brown. Oh,
that was like one of the worst records I've ever made. Oh. I always thought, who held a gun to his head and made him sing Don't Sleep in the Subway, Darling?
Winchester Cathedral. But he and in some of those cases, he could have done them well, but he just didn't apply himself. Like, he did Both Sides Now. And yeah. Sinatra could have done the definitive Both Sides Now. But for some reason, he just didn't apply himself.
I just heard Blossom Dearie singing Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head. Her treatment of it was so beautiful. I was like, oh, gosh, now I love the song and I love her even more.
That could happen, especially in Blossom Dearie's hands.
Yeah, yeah.
She was a magician. I loved her, too. I saw her quite a few times. She was absolutely nuts.
Yeah, she was a strange one.
Strange nuts. I interviewed her twice for my first book, Lush Life, my biography of Billy Strayhorn. And one time I saw her at this little club on 46th Street, and I went up to her afterwards. Hello, Boss, was a great show. And this is David Haydu. I interviewed you a couple times. No, not me. Well, I understand you do a lot of interviews. You might not remember. It was on the subject of Billy Strayhorn, who you knew in Paris when you played the Mars Club. And early said, no, not me. You never talked to me. I never talked to you. Well, no, I understand. Not me. It's like, she's all, but she gave us this magical music and had her touch in the piano was just so gorgeous and sensitive and beautiful singing. I love her.
David Haydu, your two new books are called A Revolution in Three Acts, The Radical Vaudeville of Burt Williams, Eva Tangway, and Julian Elting.
With art by John Carey.
Yeah, and a foreword by Michelle Wallace, and it's a good foreword also. And this wonderful and hilarious novel, Adrian Geffel, a fiction. And there's also Positively Fourth Street and Love for Sale and The 10 Cent Plague and the Billy Strayhorn book from, that was what, 1996 or something?
96, yeah.
Yeah. Great, wonderful books. And it's always a pleasure to talk to you. And thanks so much for being with us on From the Bookshelf.
Oh, thank you. Best day I've had in a long time. Thank you, Gary.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.